Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I am here tonight with my co-host Red Beckman and Dr. Kate. And we have some other folks that are qualified to be hosts here tonight as well. Doug Millar and Jim Cook are going to be joining us. And those two fellows are a part of the Crusade Radio bunch and also associated with United for Justice. And gentlemen, do you have live mics? If you do, I'll let you say hello. Well, I'm hearing something in the background. I got a feeling it's BTR playing an ad. So let's see what's going on with that here and how I'm going to get it shut down, because it's hard to think when I've got two things running at one time. There we go. That was strange. I don't know if anybody else could hear that or not, but it was playing in our stream. So, good. Is anybody else on with us live now?
Just your co-host, Dr. Kate.
Well, good. I'm glad there's somebody out there just so I can affirm that I'm in the right place.
Yeah, Area 603 is on, but we don't have he's not unmuted yet, and Red is not available yet.
Red had he was out chopping wood, so he told me he was going to be probably 10 minutes late because he had to get something to eat and clean himself up a little bit before dialing the phone. So he'll be with us here in just a few minutes, but that's okay. Give Gus Breton a live mic. That's 603.
603, you're live.
Hi there.
Good evening, Gus.
Good evening.
Hey, could I ask you to do the honors and open us with a prayer tonight?
Sure. Dear Heavenly Father, we come before you humbly, looking and seeking for some guidance. We ask that you bring us together in one mind and guide us through this conversation tonight so that we may walk away with as much as we can and proceed forward to the goal. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you very much, Gus. And Gus, while we're waiting for these other guys to come on here, how about letting our listeners just have a little taste of what you've been up to, where you are, who you are, and why we brought you on here like you're an expert.
All right. Well, I'm in New England, and specifically in New Hampshire, and my background's in construction. I've done a lot of research on the 13th Amendment and a lot of other stuff, but the 13th Amendment's probably what I'll be talking most about tonight. The website that I put together for that is www.nhredress.info. NH like New Hampshire, redress, REDRESS. Dot info. And when you get there, if you click on the 13th Amendment, you'll see links to about 60 Google books that are online where you can find the 13th Amendment. I've downloaded those, so I have all those same books available as a PDF, and that's probably what I'll be talking about.
13th Amendment.
I've downloaded those. So I have all the same books available as PDF.
Somebody has phone on with our stream playing in the background because it's echoing off of a computer. So you will need to mute yourself when you're not speaking. Go ahead, Gus.
So that was me. I didn't press the button for one to give me a live mic, so I was wondering how I got in there. But how are you tonight?
I'm doing good. Is this Jim?
Yes, yes. And Doug should be on with us, too.
Oh, yes, I'm
Jim, do you need to make an announcement about is this being a simulcast tonight?
We did that on our station now. We are simulcasting. Doug, you want to do the honors?
Well, we've already announced this, so I think we need to tie everybody up again.
No problem. I just wanted our listeners to know that we're simulcasting with Crusade Radio tonight, and Doug Millar and Jim Cook normally host that show, and they're going to be joining our discussion tonight. Guys, is your show for 1 hour or two?
1 hour.
Okay, but you'll be able to stay on with us for the second hour, right?
Well, all we have to do is hang up with the station, and we'll call back in separately, and we'll be able to participate in case we have an opportunity to during the second hour. And we're going to encourage everybody else to do that also. We'll be giving your number out again at the end of our broadcast.
Well, we are getting some echo from out there, so I'm just going to ask, as people are not speaking, to mute yourselves. I'll let you be responsible for that. We won't try to mute you on our switchboard, because that way we won't know when you want to come back in. So just make sure when you're not speaking to mute. I'd like to get the conversation started tonight with Stephen Charles Hance, who is one of the members of the All States Organic Initiative, along with Gus Breton and myself and others. And last night we did a little bit of a discussion on Borger Review on the Crusade Radio, but we've also had that conversation here on Walls in Our Minds before, so I don't believe we need to necessarily try to cover all of that ground. But we started into a conversation last night where Jim had raised the issue of filing something, a writ or petition or whatever, in the in a federal court, and I wanted Stephen Hance to be able to start out this conversation tonight talking about why we will not, nor do we need to find remedy in a federal court. And Stephen, are you alive?
I don't know if I'm alive or not, but I'm here.
Well, we hope not to get your blood boiling too much tonight, guys. Be kind on him. He was running a little high blood pressure last night, which Red can appreciate. We got that formula for Dr. James Walker you need to be taking if you haven't already there, Stephen. But Stephen, I'm going to give you the floor and let you expound a little bit, please.
Okay. I'll be happy to try anything else that I haven't tried already for this blood pressure, but you can shoot that to me on the email or something. Suggestion was made, I think, by Jim, I don't know who for sure brought it up, that we could use 18 U.S.C. Section 241, 242 for these judges and prosecutors and all the other perverts that violate people's rights. And that's a very common thing for people to fall back on. A part of it, I think, is it pertains to the issue that I was harping on a little bit last night about the misconception that we all have that the United States is a country or a nation. And it is nothing of the sort. It is a federation of free and independent nation states. The United States is an entity unto itself, but it is not superior to the states that created it, and we need to get it put back in the box where it belongs, which would solve 99.9% of all the problems in immigration. But this is a common theme among people, the patriots, people that have been studying the law, and they come across these wonderful statutes and the federal codes and say, well, look, that's the remedy to take care of these rascals. And if we were, if the United States was indeed a nation, and if we were all citizens of that nation, then the answer would be yes, go for it. That's your remedy. But it's not, and we aren't. So it isn't. The Title 18 USC tells you, and I think they moved it to Section 7, it tells you that the jurisdiction for this entire title is the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, which is, according to Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 17 and 18, not to exceed 10 miles square, docks, arsenals, and other needful buildings. And that's not a whole lot of land. That's not a whole lot of territory. If you add up all of the territory of the United States, they're probably, I've never really done it, but I think they could probably be fitted into the top half of New Hampshire. There's not a lot of land there, and yet this behemoth has brought itself out of the depths and insinuated itself into the states illegally, unlawfully, and without any rationale. There are a lot of rationales that are presented by people who think they're explaining great mysteries, like the so-called secret contracts that Mercier revealed in his treatise of that name. But you don't have to study contract law for more than a couple of hours to understand that there's no such thing as a secret contract. It's absolutely impossible for a secret contract to exist. And I guess I'm sounding like I'm rambling, but really there's a point to all of this, and that is that the jurisdiction of the statutes of the United States Congress are ultimately limited by the enumerated powers of Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 16, and the last two clauses of that section, where the federal domain, the federal zone, was created. And when you try to enforce federal statutes, no matter how good they sound, in the states, you are really attempting the impossible. Those statutes cannot be applied lawfully in the states. I know what everybody's saying. They do it all the time. Yeah, that's right. They do. It's true. That's why I was, my boys and I spent almost 6 years in federal prison. It was because they were enforcing statutes without authority. And that's why we need the boards of review to bring the government agents back under the rule of law and get rid of the false arrests, the false imprisonments, and the false use of federal statutes. Did I say too much to make any sense?
No, that wasn't exactly what I thought you were going to say, but it all made sense. I do want to let everyone know that Red Beckman is online with us as well. So, Red, I acknowledged you earlier, but I don't think you were on yet. I just want to let everybody know you're here. So if anybody's got any questions of Red, he's ready and available.
I got one question. You made a statement that you said that these laws can't apply to you. I'm going to make a statement, and I want your opinion of it. When I was in New York, I was caught for driving without a driver's license, and I informed the police that I was actually traveling by automobile and exercising a right, and if they violated that right, it was a 10-year prison sentence and a $10,000 fine. The case was dismissed in court because I sent the ticket back in, which was the contract that they wanted me it was an offer to contract, so I sent back in saying I did not want a contract. What is your take on that as the ticket being the contract?
Well, it's obviously a presentment falls under the rules of the UCC, and that's how they snare people all the time. I'm not sure I understand what your question is.
Because we've got
such a large number
of people on tonight, I'd like for you, each one of you, to state your name when you speak so that our listeners will know who is speaking, please.
Okay. This is Jim Cook. What I want you to tell your audience, you're bringing good information out there, how they can actually turn the tide, how they can take these offers to contract and deal with them so they'll know how the mechanism to exercise the rights. That's what I'm really looking for you to explain to all of us.
Sounds to me like you're, this is Steve Hance, sounds to me like you're at least as well qualified and probably more so than I am to do that.
Well, I'm just a listener here. And I know you know about all this. The people don't understand that we only have one law, which is corpus, which means in Latin, body of crime. And you either have to commit injury, loss, or harm, and there has to be a victim. That's the only thing that we can be held accountable in a court for. Everything else is code and entered into under contract. And if you rise for a judge when he comes in, you're saying, okay, I'm abdicating my authority because of the fact that we are the kings and queens of this company, our country, and we're abdicating our position to the judge, recognizing his authority over us in a court of law. And second thing is that when we go into a court of law, we're under the admiralty jurisdiction of the flag. The flag is not an American constitutional flag. It's a UCC code flag of contract, which is the maritime flag, which only has authority 100 miles off our coast. So they use that for commerce. But basically, that's all I really have to say about that, and I want to continue listening to what you have to say.
Okay. Again, Stephen Hance here. I think I understand your point, and it's well made. What I'm trying to get through to people's minds is, I think, a step above and beyond what you're advocating, which there's nothing wrong with what you're advocating, but utilize federal statutes. It sounds really great, and yeah, it's right there in black and white that this rascal has wronged me or someone else under color of law. If they violated my rights under color of law, then they should be prosecuted. But that's not the right way to deal with it, because you are actually breathing life into the fiction that the federal statutes have an applicable character outside of the federal zone. And that's the basic concept that I'm trying to establish in people's minds, is that it doesn't have that character. It cannot ever obtain that character. It is fraudulent and coercive and unconstitutional. It violates the laws of nations. You could no more bring the lawfully, you could no more lawfully bring the statutes and codes of the United States into North Carolina, for example, than you could take them into China. It's a different jurisdiction. It's a different country altogether. The federal zone is a in that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 and 18 perspective is a national form of government, but it pertains not to any of the several states. It pertains only to the federal zone. And so that's why we need to get our minds sharpened to the reality of the truth of the matter. And if you go and try to utilize federal statutes in the states, you're just giving life to a lie. And that's why we need to concentrate on what the real issue is. The real issue is this is a federal judge sitting in a federal court illegally, unlawfully. He's beyond the realm of his jurisdiction and authority. The real issue is he has no right to even address me. The issue is federal statutes belong in the federal zone and nowhere else, with the exception of federal statutes that are written and applied to the powers created by and given to the U.S. Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 16. Those enumerated powers, absolutely, the Congress has the obligation to legislate within the various states, the several states, with anything that's pertinent to those items. For example, Congress shall have power to establish post offices and post roads. We can't stop them from doing that. They have to do it. And so they have a legitimate function within the states to provide post offices and post roads. But that doesn't mean that they can bring their jurisdiction outside of the post office or beyond the concept of the process of building the road. And another note, another point on that scale is that they don't own the land when they build the roads. That's another misconception that we've been coerced into accepting, that these federal highways are transformed from public land that belongs to the states into federal territory, and it is not their territory. They have the right and the obligation to build the roads, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says they own that land. They don't own the roads, and they don't own the land underneath them. So it's a matter of getting a proper focus. Excuse me. It's a matter of getting a proper focus in mind, and I guess you could liken it to shooting at the foot or shooting at the head. You know, if you can shoot them in the foot, it hurts like hell, and they're going to have problem walking, but they're not dead. You go for the headshot, and that is coerenta. Where is your authority? What are you doing outside of your box? That's a headshot. And that's where I think we should concentrate on aiming whenever we're dealing with these rascals.
I think some folks may have missed your definition of federal zone, Stephen. And one of the one of our regular listeners in the chat room asked about Does that mean that OBOT doesn't have the right to stop the XL pipeline from going across Montana?
Say that again, please.
Well, first of all, I think some folks might have missed your definition of the federal zone, but also one of our chatters said, does that mean that OBOT or Obama does not have the right to stop the XL pipeline from going across Montana?
Well, where would he get the authority to do that? He's in the executive branch, allegedly. He would be if he was qualified to hold office. But what does that have to do with, I don't understand where that would come from.
Well, the fact that it's a pipeline going through a state, unless it got into the interstate commerce situation, what right would he have to stop that pipeline in Montana?
I don't think he would have any right. I mean, where does the Constitution gives Congress the authority to regulate commerce? But the Lopez decision in, what was it, 95, 96, in the U.S. Supreme Court said, you know, the U.S. government has been using the Commerce Clause for generations, and it's unwarranted, and it's unconstitutional for them to say that they can do anything they want in the name of regulating commerce. What's interesting to me from that revelation is that the Lopez decision didn't shut the federal government down at all. I was sitting in the federal prison reading that case and thinking, what the heck is going on here? What am I doing in prison? These knuckleheads were shut down in 96. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but to me, it's very cut and dried and clear.
Yeah, I would agree with you. What about giving us a little bit clearer definition of what you call the federal zone? Because the federal, you know, they try to take the country and cut it up into 10 federal zones, and really there's only one federal zone, is there not? I mean, there's different components of it, but
right. Federal domain, federal zone.
Jurisdiction.
Article 1, Section 8, the Congress shall have power, and there are 16 clauses to lay and collect taxes, imposts, excises, to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to establish on and on and on down to number 17. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, and, clause 18, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Those two clauses define the parameters for creating a federal zone. Exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. That means the U.S. Congress has absolute authority for legislating within that zone, within that territorial area. And it's not contiguous area because it clearly states that in the various states, the United States might decide that they need to build a post office. They might need to build a fort, an arsenal, a dockyard, whatever. But they can't just go out willy-nilly and do it. They've got to locate the piece of land that they want, and they have to haggle with the state over the price. They have to pay for it with gold or silver coin, and the legislature of the state has to cede the land to the United States, and the U.S. Congress has to accept it. All of those things have to be done before the federal zone can be moved into an area within the external boundaries of any of the several states. Does that clarify it for you?
Yeah, you mean for the listeners?
I didn't mean to impugn your intelligence.
Wouldn't be the first time, probably won't be the last.
Well, I try to be nice.
should we give you opportunity here, since you're saying that the federal courts are not the correct route for solving these problems? Should we give you the opportunity to give us what you perceive to be your a proper solution, or should we turn to Gus and give you your voice a rest and let him bring out the information on the 13th before we go there?
Either way is fine with me. I'm good with it either way. I'd like to put Gus on the spot.
Gus, are you unmuted?
Yes, I am.
Well, tell us a little bit about your research on the 13th and what you discovered, and maybe go to the point of why it's so important.
All right. The 13th Amendment was put up as an amendment in 1810, and a couple states ratified it in 1810, another 9 states in 1811, and then 2 more in 1812. And the amendment, actually, I should have pulled it up before I started talking. I'll pull it up now.
Well,
and,
first thing, we're not talking about what they're printing currently in the Constitution is the 13th Amendment, right?
That's correct. The 13th Amendment that we now know, that we were taught in school, is what's known as the Slavery Amendment. The 14th Amendment is the Citizens Amendment. And then, those were at one point the 14th and 15th, and not actually the 13th and 14th. I'll pull it up right now. The like I said earlier, the website is www.nhredress.info, and if you go there, you'll see a link for the 13th Amendment, and that's where you can find it. So the amendment reads, "If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, or receive or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall without the consent of Congress accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them." Now, one of the implications of this is a lot of people are saying, when people go to court, you have the judge, Your Honor, that's a position of honor, and it's accepted from the British Crown, and then you have titles of nobility, which is what an esquire is. One of the things that people don't talk about very often is receiving emoluments or gifts or presents of any kind, whatever, from a foreign power. And a foreign power, if you look at IBM, Microsoft, different corporations, there's a lot of people that sit on these boards of directors that are foreign. and they're contributing to campaigns that people are running to get elected to different positions. Well, in that particular instance, it's my belief that they are receiving money, presents, emoluments from foreign powers, and they should be stripped of their citizenship. Now, this sounds kind of harsh, but it would certainly put an end to what's going on in our country if the attorneys were not allowed to run for office, and those who were running for office actually had to run based on their speech and on their character and on what their record was and not on how much money they could raise. So this amendment, like I said, it was at first was proposed in 1810. It was ratified by 1812. It was published in the Buren and Duane Statutes at Large in 1813 with the caveat that said that it was there as a reference only because they had not yet verified that it was fully ratified. 2 years later, in 1815, it was printed again without the caveat in its proper place as an amendment, as a fully ratified amendment. And then while James Monroe was president, there was a resolution on the House floor to find out for sure in December of 1817, whether or not that amendment was indeed fully ratified, because some people were questioning it at the time. And so the House resolution was put out. John Quincy Adams at the time was the Secretary of State, and he reported to the House that, yes, indeed, based on the records at hand, that the amendment was actually fully ratified and was indeed the 13th Amendment of the United States. It was printed again in 1825 in the Military Laws of the United States, and it was printed in tons and tons of books. I've got, if you go to Google Books and you put the language of the 13th Amendment into Google Books, which I've done, and I've posted the results on that website I gave you earlier, you'll find about 60 different Google books, which are mostly statutes from Connecticut, Rhode Island, Kansas, Missouri. I don't remember all the states. But, you know, these are the statutes from those books over a 50-year span, which have the 13th Amendment listed. So it was printed in the statutes of the several states for at least 50 years on a regular basis, and up to 65 years later, it was in 1786, it was printed in Wyoming. And, that one in Wyoming in 1876 had the original 13th Amendment in its proper place. What we know now as the 13th Amendment was printed as the 14th, and what we now know as the 14th Amendment was printed as the 15th in that year. So it mostly disappeared around the time of the Civil War with the Reconstruction Acts. So I think there was a whole lot more than just the Civil War going on, and I think it had a lot more to do with getting rid of. Okay, I just got muted and unmuted. There's a lot of information available online for anybody who's looking for it. But this needs to be brought to light that it was actually ratified and it was in effect for 50 years.
Well, if we know that it was, we've confirmed that it was ratified, and if it was printed as a part of the Constitution, at least from 1821 through, as far as we know, up into the 1870s. In some places, I know in Colorado, for example, it was 1868, printed in 1868 Constitution in Colorado and placed on record in the state library. We know that it was also put in a library in Wyoming in the 1870s. If it's never been repealed, then we're faced with complete and total fraud on pretty much everything that's happened since the Reconstruction.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's when it disappeared.
And it looks like, at least on the federal level and perhaps even in the states, that nearly a majority, if not a majority, of those elected officials in legislature today are attorneys, correct?
There's in New Hampshire, we have, I think, 400 state reps, and I believe right now there's about 14 of them that are attorneys. And one of the benefits we have in New Hampshire, some people don't see it as a benefit, is that our state reps are paid $100 a year. So there's no money in it. And for the amount of time that people put in, you really have to be doing it to serve. You're not doing it to make any money. So, you know, as an attorney, if you're willing to give up that much time in your practice to be, you know, volunteering your time, then great. But, you know, typically the New Hampshire state rep is somebody who's lived their life, has gotten a lot of experience, and is able to take that time and volunteer his time. So I know that's quite different from most of the other states, but I know the amount of attorneys in other states in those positions is definitely higher. That's what I've been hearing for a long time.
Well, it's been proven that the what is known as the 14th today, which you're saying is really the 15th, which I agree would have been the 15th had it been properly ratified. We know based on the Utah Supreme Court case, Dyett versus Turner, that it was not lawfully ratified, and if you could have deemed it ratified, a good portion of the ones that supposedly ratified it did so at gunpoint, which would nullify it because they were under duress. They were given no choice. They unseated them from the federal legislature and seated their own people in order to get it ratified is the way that they did it. And it was so it's a matter of record, both from that court case, that Supreme Court case in the state of Utah, as well as what's known as the Georgia Memorial Petition that was issued in 1957, which was never responded to, and as of 2007, after 50 years, that became law. So we also know that what is currently known as the 15th was not properly ratified, and Red Beckman, who is on this call, sent Bill Benson out to 48 states to collect certified documents proving that the 16th and 17th Amendments were never lawfully ratified. Is that correct, Red? Do you need to unmute yourself to come in on that?
That is correct. But I need to stress that Bill Benson didn't get involved in the research until 1983. The Montana Historian started in June of 1980, and they had the documents proving from the states. They had the documents proving that the 16th Amendment and the 17th, that they were never properly ratified. But the federal judges in the courts refused to let us use those documents in cases because they said they weren't certified. Bill Benson was had the experience of an investigator, criminal investigator, and we more or less hired him, what it amounted to go out, take the documents out, and go to the states and say, here, we've got these documents and we want them certified. And it cost us, of course, to get them certified. And, of course, the system, our legal political system is so corrupt that even after we had everything certified, the courts were still, they were still criminal courts, and they were run by lawyers, of course, in black dresses, and they to this day, the book The Law That Never Was, which I co-authored with Bill Benson, came out in April of 1985. And so we've got quite a few years here that have gone by, and the federal courts refuse to accept this stuff. I think we know how to do it now. I think we can do it if we, do it right, perhaps. But that's not my strong suit anymore. It's not what I really spend much time on, other than that every American that can afford it should have a copy of The Law That Never Was in their home, simply because it's a great educational tool. We have to educate our fellow Americans. This is the high value, as far as I'm concerned, with the fraud of the 13th Amendment. We knew about the missing 13th Amendment by about 1982 or 81 or 82 when we discovered, the Montana historians discovered the missing 13th. And so this evidence has been around for a long time, but it is not going to be effective. This is what we've got to understand. We've got to recognize it. And that is that the American public are mentally crippled by the government education system. And we are outnumbered by such a wide margin that we are not going to change anything. We're not going to turn it around. And right at the moment, I'm doing some writing and explaining some of this stuff because the federal government is going to self-destruct. It's in the process right now. The federal government system is in violation of the common law we know of as the Ten Commandments. The first and second commandment, the government is in violation of those laws, and it is not going to survive those mistakes. The USSR didn't survive those mistakes, and neither is the United States of America going to the federal government. Neither is the federal government going to survive that mistake. I'm doing some writing, and I made the comment that it has been just 22 years since the USSR was dissolved and went down, and look what has happened in 22 years. And with a tongue-in-cheek, I suggested that we hire Vladimir Putin to come over and help us put our system back together and put it back together properly. This research that all the people are doing, we knew about this stuff a long time ago when I ran for governor in Montana back in the 80s. I had plans to... Well, I was on the Democratic Party ticket. My whole family disowned me because my whole family had always been Republicans. And I ran as a Democrat, and I said I was a Jeffersonian Democrat, and if they didn't agree with Jefferson, I had to assume that they were Karl Marx Democrats. And so I said that I would work with every public school in the state of Montana, because that's where we've got to start. That's where we've got to have most of our effort pointed and focused, because we have to educate. We have to do some a tremendous, monstrous job of re-educating the American people. But we need this research on like the 13th Amendment, because we need to use that in the education process, where we explain to our fellow countrymen that the ink wasn't even dry when the delegates signed the Constitution back there in 1787 and the Bill of Rights in 1791. And there were those trying to subvert the system. And they were very, very successful. And we are seeing the evidence of that here every day. But we need the accurate evidence of this mischief that was caused to happen in this country by the schemers, the outlaws, the gangster, political gangsters that did not want the people of this country to be kings and queens in their castles. We've got a major job to do, and I just wish I was a little more involved than I am today, but my days are numbered, so I've said all I can say right now, I'm sure. And have all this evidence put together in an orderly fashion. Thank you.
Thank you, Red. I know Jim Cook wants to make a comment about the 16th Amendment. Before I turn the floor back to Stephen, and I want Stephen to bring out the statistics that he's looked up regarding what percentage of our U.S. Congress and Senate are attorneys, but I also want you, Stephen, to tell us how to best go about doing just what Red just said, and that's to educate the people, and also how to put this government back in its constitutional box. Jim, you've got a couple minutes here to talk about the 16th before I bring Stephen back on.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
You're fine, yes.
Hello? Okay, well, first of all, you're totally right. The 16th Amendment was only ratified by about three states when the Secretary of the Treasury then just pronounced it was ratified and that it was codified in law, supposedly. But the Secretary of State never had that authority to do that, so it's the law that never was. But on top of that, what people don't understand is that the 16th Amendment created no new taxation. If you look at the 16th Amendment compared to the other statutes on taxation, which means that all taxes have to be apportioned, which means that everybody would pay the same. The middle class, the poor, and the rich would all pay the same percentage of tax, which is the apportionment clause in the Constitution. Basically, it boils down to this. The IRS, because of that clause, and because it created no new tax, basically they worded the 26th statute of the IRS code in such a way as that it didn't pertain to the American people. Because in the statute, it defines the United States, like I said last night, as Washington, D.C., and the territories of the United States, which we're not a part of. But also, if you look up Section 3401C, which 3401 are the definitions of the IRS code. 3401C is the definition of employee. And if you decipher the wording in that that section,
Jim,
it says specifically that it has to be, you have to be either a state or federal elected official, federal
Jim,
employee, or corporate officer.
Jim.
Yes.
We've gone into the 16th many times here. Even our listeners are part of the choir that you're preaching to at the moment. But it's been, you know, clearly defined that the 16th Amendment was nothing more than a bluff to try to overcome the 1895 Supreme Court decision that nullified the Income Tax Act of 1894, stating specifically that it was a non-apportioned direct tax and therefore unlawful. And this 16th Amendment was really just a smokescreen to justify the crime that was committed through our Congress. And the Supreme Court on more than one occasion has specifically stated that it conveyed no new taxing power. So that's kind of a given. I'd like to get back
and
to I think we're kind of veering
said.
A little off course of where the conversation
Right, but I just wanted to explain that little piece. Also, it was recodified in the Tom Crier court case in 2005, where it came out in the court that the Supreme Court did rule on its face that the income tax was unconstitutional. So you're right. That's all I wanted to say on that point.
Thanks. Stephen, give us the statistics on the attorneys.
I just did a brief search on the Internet, and according to a recent Google search, they reported that 43% of Congress are attorneys, and that breaks down to, 60% of the U.S. Senate and 37.2% of the House of Representatives. So that's a pretty good chunk of attorneys. There's also a pretty good showing of doctors and people in the medical profession and real estate. So there's no problem with the doctors and realtors being involved, but 43% of the total of the U.S. Congress is a very significant bunch. And then when you look at judges, prosecuting attorneys, attorney general, there's no place in the Constitution for an attorney general or a district attorney, because there's no place for an attorney.
So everyone, even at the caucus level, needs to really be watching for this, because you're going to find that a high percentage of those that the establishment Republicans are putting forward as candidates are, in fact, attorneys. But tell us, Stephen, what your opinion is of the best way to go about putting this out of control, outside the Constitution, criminal group in Washington, D.C. How do we best go about holding our government accountable and putting them back into the constitutional box?
Well, you could be a lawyer, because lawyers never ask a question they don't know the answer to. So you know what my answer to that is. The boards of review that I patterned after Article 61 of the Magna Carta, I believe, is the only viable solution to the problem that we have in the Federation and in the individual states. Every state government, every county government, every township, city government has all been co-opted, right down to the utility company where you get your electricity from, in many cases, to the Board of Education, the school district. These people, they have created subordinate corporations, and everything is corporatized under the British Crown Corporation. It goes all the way back to the Knights Templar, and you know, the the confab that they had with the Vatican. So we've got to step outside of the government structure itself, because it is totally, totally corrupt, as I believe it was Isaiah that Yahweh was speaking to, and he said, the whole head is sick. It's completely corrupt. And that's where we are in the American Federation, called the United States of America. It's not the government that's at fault. It's the people that are in office, and it's the dare I say, the conspiracy of devil worshippers, Luciferians, whose goal and plan is our destruction. And so it's a matter of self-preservation for the people of the several states to stand up and put this monster back into the box where it belongs, and get rid of all the corruption. Get rid of all of the attorneys that have caused the corruption. Get rid of all of the bogus laws where these guys come into an office and unconstitutionally vote themselves a pay raise. And, I mean, they've done that for years and years. They give themselves so many amenities and benefits that they're not entitled to, and the corruption has to be addressed by the people, su espante, which means simply from our own spontaneous gestures, initiatives. That's why I called the group that I started here, the All States Organic Initiative. We've got to take the initiative ourselves. It's got to come from within our own hearts and souls, and joining together with each other to form these boards of review and tell the people in government, we're not trying to alter or abolish anything. We're simply telling you that the time has come for you to obey the law, for you to obey the oath of office that you took. And if you didn't take it, it doesn't matter. You're still bound to the oath that's required of you to hold the office in a public office. The people have to do it. The courts won't do it. You've got the enemies of the state are running the chicken house. Their attorneys are running the show, and they're not going to vote themselves out of office. They are not going to grow a conscience and do it because it's the right thing to do. We have to do it, and the Board of Review is the only thing I've seen that has the ability, the power, directly from the people, to hold these guys accountable.
Well, obviously, we're not going to be able to do that at the federal level at this juncture. So we've got to start right in our backyard, don't we? And
What about Red's
point that this regime is going to self-destruct? How does that play into this?
Well, it plays into it very simply. They've planned for the self-destruction, and they have a plan for pardon me. They have a plan for what they're going to do when the self-destruction occurs. They've got at least 200 thousand, probably a half a million or more Chinese soldiers in humongous camps just south of in Mexico, just waiting for the orders to march across the border and take control of the states. Oh, they've got all kinds of plans that are already in the works for dealing with people like you and me and our listeners when that happens. And there are, in my belief system, I believe we're not that dissimilar from the circumstances that Abraham found himself in when the three visitors came to see him and told him that they were going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And what did he say? He said, well, what if there were, I don't remember the exact numbers, 100 righteous men? And they said, 50. Well, if we had 100 righteous men, we won't destroy the city. Okay, well, and he went on and said, how about 50? How about 10? And they said, look, if we can find 10 righteous men, we won't destroy them. Well, apparently Lot was a righteous man, but there wasn't enough righteous men. I mean, there weren't even 10 righteous men in those two cities, in that whole region, and so they were destroyed. Now, what I've been telling people for years is that I know of one righteous man, and since that time, I've met other righteous men, like Gus and Ed and Terry and Jim Cook and others that we've met along the road. There are righteous men. There are righteous women in this federation of states, and these guys are not going to succeed. They may be allowed to bring destruction in a measure because the people of the United States of America are corrupt as their government is. And so, yeah, there may be some horrific things awaiting, but they will not destroy this federation because of the righteous people that are in it. And by the way, righteousness has nothing to do with going to church. You read your Bible, study the words. Righteousness and justice are the same words in both the so-called Greek or the so-called Hebrew, which is really the Chaldean language, and Greek. Righteousness and justice are the same word. They're translated differently in different places, but it's the same word. If you want to understand what righteousness means, you won't find it at church, because all those blowhards will do is tell you, well, righteousness means right standing with God. But it doesn't. It means protecting the rights of other people. That's what righteousness means. That's what a righteous man does. And there are righteous men and there are righteous women in this federation. I'm sorry, I got to quit.
Stephen, do you have water with you?
Yeah, sorry.
Why don't you take a break and get you a good drink? I was thinking more along the lines of how can the border review hasten that destruction of this regime. And I really, again, I don't believe there's much that anybody can do at the federal level at this point, but we can certainly be working on our local levels and using the Boards of Review to make change in the local and in counties and states and townships and prepare people so that when it does go down, we've got a handle on things in our local area, our local commerce, our local sheriff, and we as a collective group of small pockets across the country can make a huge difference when that goes down. But I want to bring Red back in. Red, I hope you were listening to Stephen's comments and can contribute what your thinking on that is.
I'm convinced that George Bush Sr., you remember, in a speech he made when he was president, he had a speech before the Congress, State of the Union, and he said, you're going to get a one world order, a new world order, whether you like it or not. This is the goal of the Luciferians, is to bring in a new world order. And that new world order is nothing more than a satanic counterfeit to the promise that we have from our Messiah King that he is going to return. I pray that prayer, the last prayer in the Bible, as often as I think of it, which is pretty often. Even so, come Lord Jesus. And he is coming back. He's coming back with the New Jerusalem. And I think that that is probably the thing that we should be, you know, should be really stimulating our actions, our activities, the very idea that that kingdom is going to, it's coming, it's going to arrive. And when we read Matthew 24, of course, we see where there's some hard times coming before that happens. So, you know, I said earlier here that I hope that these people that are doing all this research and such will be very accurate with what they're doing, and so that they establish a record that will hold up when these terrible times will come when the federal God, as I call it, is brought down, and there's going to be some real serious problems because of the ignorance of the American people. And you see, it's just well, what I said, of course, was that the government, the federal God, is going to come down because of their violations of the common law. God's law is the common law, and the first and second commandments. That is what brought down the USSR. Now, I'm not a majority when I say that, but I wrote that up way back there when it happened. And so I hold that position yet to this day, that is what brought it down. It wasn't Ronald Reagan in West Berlin, telling the East Germans to take down the wall. That isn't what did it. It was our Heavenly Father that brought down the USSR. And the same thing is going to happen here, but I am concerned because of this, the mental crippling that has taken place in this country. You cannot believe a lot of lies. You can't be deceived without paying a price. And so, we're paying a price right now. I mean, the price we're paying right as we do this program tonight is the price is very high but I fear that it will get higher. Now, you want to remember that the Russian people had no clue. They went to bed one night and had no clue that their national government, the USSR, would be dissolved overnight. The same identical thing could happen right here, because the same gang of outlaws that controlled the USSR controlled the United States of America as we speak. And they got away with it. They managed to get away with it then in December of 91. But I think it's going to be somewhat different here, but it'll be the same Luciferian gangsters that are going to bring it about and try to bring in the New World Order talked about by George Bush Sr. back in about 89 or 90. I don't remember exactly when he made that speech, but that's what's in the works out there, and we've got plenty of people in this country that are gonna fall for that because of the steady diet of deceit and deception that they have absorbed over the years. So as you can tell, I'm losing my voice, so I better shut down again for a bit.
Well, we've got a hand up in area code 970, and I am betting that that is our good friend Dennis. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're right. This is Dennis Spencer. How are you?
Good evening, Dennis. Glad to have you a part of this conversation. Hope you've been able to hear some of it.
I've listened since about 7:30. I got in late, working all day, so I couldn't join you at the very beginning. But been mulling over. You know, we met together. What was that? Monday morning. You and I did out there where you live. I won't tell you where you live, but been mulling over the idea of having a board of review. And how? In one of the main things that we've been thinking of, and I'm sure that has a lot of people's question in their mind, is how do we get recognized as a board of review to do it? And by its very nature, it should be. But a lot of people would think, well, they're not going to recognize that anyway. But I have a plan. If you'd like to hear it, want to hear it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, if you live in a state that has ballot initiative processes, you could go to even as small as a town or a city, and the smaller the easier it is, but you come out with a ballot initiative program to get them to recognize it. And it can be simple as the city of fill in your city shall recognize the board of review in whatever you're going to call it. You know, the let's just say you live in Castle Rock board of review, you know, something really simple, and have a lot of people. Well, usually only takes like 5% or more to sign it to get a petition to be heard and put it on a ballot so people will actually vote on that. And it's mandatory here in Colorado that they have to do that. However, prior to that time, you could actually have a city or a county just pass a resolution that they're going to recognize the board. So you form your board of review, and then you have the city or county, you know, through much pressure by showing up at the meetings, just say, yes, we pass a resolution that we recognize the, you know, Castle Rock board of review. You know, of course, I know how to put it all together and everything from what you told me. If you don't live in a state that recognizes the ballot initiative processes, and there's considerable, there's 25 throughout the United States that do not have it, then you just go, first of all, then you go to the city or county at which you live, I'm talking local, and have them stealthily have them say, hey, we want to be able to have a, you know, it's part of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution that we can petition the government. So we want to be able to have petitions to be able to hear our issues, you know, heard by you guys, to be able to gets, you know, some laws passed through this petition process, and just have them do a resolution that say, you know, again, I'll use Castle Rock. The city of Castle Rock will now be able to do ballot initiative processes, you know. So anyway, that's how you get it recognized in that. But I do have a question. You told me about the marshals that were appointed, and they were called Special United States of America Marshals. And I did some research on that too. Terry and Steve, if you're there, the idea of a marshal is a branch of the executive. But when you say special, oh, I'd like to hear more of what you have to say about that. First of all, you can comment on the ballot initiative process if you have anybody have any questions on that, and I'll shut up.
Thanks, Dennis. That's a great question. Stephen, is your throat good enough that you can respond? Because I got a feeling I know exactly what you're going to say if you want me to say it.
Didn't know it was that predictable. you're welcome to chime in whenever you want. My first reaction what Dennis said is if you ask to be recognized, there's a 50-50 chance they'll say no. So what have you accomplished? Even if they say yes, we will recognize you, still establish that they are in a superior position from you. And with regard to petitioning this and petitioning that, we're way beyond petitioning. We're in the point of experience that the colonies were in 1776. Their boards of review had sent petitions. Their boards of review had talked about the issues and the problem. Finally said, you know what? The king doesn't listen. Parliament doesn't listen. Soldiers don't listen. They don't care about our rights. We're beyond petition. It's a point in time where we have to say we have the right of self-determination. We have the right of self-governance, and we're going to take it. Boards of review were not invented, for lack of a better word, for the purpose of petitioning anybody for anything. We petition the Father in heaven, the self-existing one, but with regard to the government structure and the public officers that inhabit that structure, we don't ask them for anything. We give them orders. We tell them what's going to happen, and they obey, or they force us into a confrontation. The boards of review is about the people taking the authority that they possess within their souls and putting it on the record, in writing, in public, to the various officers that are supposed to be serving the people. So that's my response to what Dennis had to say.
Well, that's exactly what I expected you to say. And Dennis, I guess I'm what I would like to see personally. First of all, I don't want to take the time that would require to go through a ballot initiative to set up boards of review, but I believe that the ballot initiative could be one of the tools that a board of review might want to use in order to put especially the state officials back into their constitutional box. The board of review, Red hit the nail on the head a while ago when he was talking about common law. We've got to reinstate the common law. Well, our right not privilege, but our right to establish boards of review is a function of common law. And we don't need anybody's permission, so we gain nothing if they say yes on the ballot initiative, other than the recognition of a few people that we have that right. But if it's a right, we don't need their permission. We just have to do it. And there is a risk. They say no, and now you're in a position of you're the one that asked for the ballot initiative. Now, if for some reason it goes down, you've given up a right, which you otherwise needed no permission for. So I see a ballot initiative related to the acknowledgement of the Board of Review as going backwards. So, but it is a good tool. The ballot initiative is an excellent tool and could be, should be in the quiver of your local Board of Review. You want to make any more comment related to the common law? Because that's precisely, this whole thing comes right out of common law, and it's specifically based on, and I think it's only one example, but it's the best one we have, of being Article 61 of the Magna Carta.
The common law, one of the problems we have, you see, is that these lawyers you see, the Bill of Rights was attached to the Constitution in December of 1791. By 1795, lawyers had gained control of the United States Congress. And, of course, when they voted to give England millions of dollars in reparations, that got the attention of Benjamin Franklin and others, and that's what gave birth to the idea of the 13th Amendment. That was where we lost the common law when they dropped the 13th Amendment through the cracks. We lost the common law at that point, as far as I'm concerned, for the most part. We lost it, and this is why you don't find any attorneys or judges or politicians out there talking about the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. The law schools in this country, being under the control of the bar in London, England, they do not teach anything about the common law. And so we have very, very few of our American citizens that know that there is such a thing as the common law. And I spend, that's why my voice is so bad tonight, I spent a lot of time on the phone today explaining this, the common law and what has happened to it, on the phone. And it's just something that has to be done. I think I've told the story about the attorney in Montana when I was still back in my home state of Montana. An attorney called because he had an IRS problem, and he had been practicing law for about 20 years. And I asked him if he knew what the 7th article of the Bill of Rights had to say. And he thought for quite a while, and then he said, well, that just secures our right to a jury trial in a civil matter. I said, well, what about the rest of it? He couldn't say. And so he got his textbook down from the University of Montana Law School and checked it out, and they had spent weeks studying the First Amendment. They studied weeks, studying the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments, And all that textbook had to say about the seventh was that it preserved the right to a jury trial. They didn't talk about the common law at all. And so, of course, I point the finger at the preachers in our pulpits because God's law is common law. And you have never heard, I've never heard, I don't think there's a preacher in this country, unless he's been informed along the same lines that some of us have, they're not talking about the common law. They don't talk about the common law that the Ten Commandments is the common law. And it's the original law that we were to live under right here in this country. And so the common law is very near and dear to my heart because we've had, you know, wonderful success beating the U.S. tax court, which is not hard to do because it isn't even a court. But we have been able to beat the tax court in every single case that I have been able to advise people on. And it's been so easy because all we have to do is cite the fact that that judge in that tax court is a beneficiary of the tax laws. And he is going, when that trial in a tax court happens, that tax court judge makes all findings of fact and conclusions of law. But when you cite him for his conflict of interest, it just takes all of the wind out of his sails and puts him down, and he has no authority whatever to make findings of fact or conclusions of law in a tax matter because he's a beneficiary of the tax laws. Now, that's not difficult. That's common law, and that's how common law works. And so I'm a real fan of common law at this point, and I'm sure everybody understands that from having listened to me. But the common law jury, of course, of the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, the common law jury of that of the common law is the highest court in our land. It's a higher court than the U.S. Supreme Court because the Supreme Court is just 9 lawyers and they're all beneficiaries of the tax laws. They are government agents, and that's so simple. When you cite them for that, you find that they will head for cover. I better shut up again.
Well, Stephen, you might want to share, because I think the rest of Dennis's question was pertaining to your special marshals, and you might need to relate that story. What have you to say about that?
I'll be happy to do that. Is that what you were getting at, Dennis?
Yeah, if I'm not muted still, yes. He told that story to me, and that'd be good. Something that would be really good for the audience, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I tell the story whenever it's right. It illustrates very, very graphically the reality of what we're talking about with regard to the authority of the people to create the boards of review and the question that's always in people's mind is similar to what you brought up earlier. It was brought up yesterday, last night on the call, and that is, how are you going to get people to recognize your board of review? How are you going to get enforcement? And really, that question those questions come from a lack of understanding the reality of what I will reveal in the heart of this little story. It's a true story, and the way we got the story related to me was my friend Leroy Michael Schweitzer, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the Justice Township in Montana, and my sons and I were there in 1996 when the feds closed their two-year sting operation on those people and attacked us, led to the 81-day siege that I'm sure most of you heard about. But what they did, irrespective of what mistakes were made, they created a common law court, a new township on the land, and a return to the for the purpose of returning to a constitutional republican form of government. Now, when we got all, when we all got locked up after the 81 days, we decided we had done all that we could do without just having an all-out firefight. We should go to the courts. That's another story. But we went, we got locked up. We were locked up for over 2 years before they went to trial. And during that 2 years, we formed our own court in the jailhouse, and we appointed ourselves and each other as justices and one clerk. And it came time for having enforcement, and so we decided the only way we're going to do it is if we appoint our own marshals. So we did. I wrote up an order for appointment, described the position, the duties of the office, and the power of the office. We signed it. We put the court seal on it, and we sent it out for three appointments. Those three marshals took their appointments seriously to an extent. Fast forward a couple of years, I'm in prison in Talladega. Leroy's in prison in Aiken, South Carolina. And I get letters smuggled to me from Leroy, from people that, prisoners that he met in Aiken who were being moved to a lower, lower level, security level prison where I was in Talladega. So I get the letter along with a first-hand experience report from a first-hand experience, the guy who brought me the letter. In the letter, Leroy described to me the case that that he established. He set the court in the federal prison in Aiken, South Carolina. They adjudicated the cases, and they wrote their orders to remand the prisoners into the custody of our marshals. So he sent the orders to the marshals in Montana, and two of the three marshals took it seriously enough to drive all the way across the state to South Carolina to take possession of the take custody of the prisoners. When they got to Aiken, they went to the sheriff's office. They met with the sheriff. They told him they were special United States of America marshals. Showed him their appointment papers with our signatures and our little court seal. And the sheriff, they told the sheriff that they were there to get the prisoners, and he would be escorting them to the prison and get the job done. Sorry, folks. But the sheriff said, are you boys claiming to be U.S. Marshals? And they said, no, that's not what we said. Read the appointment. We are Special United States of America Marshals. There's the court. There's the appointment papers. And he said, well, I don't know what's supposed to happen next, boys. If you was claiming to be U.S. Marshals, I'd have to put you under arrest. But now I don't know what's supposed to happen next. Now, that's where the whole thing fell apart. The two marshals, number one, they didn't have any guns with them. Number two, they didn't understand or really believe in their hearts that those appointments were valid and just as lawful as any U.S. Marshal's appointment papers and documentation, or that of the sheriff or his deputies, for that matter. So they turned tail and went home. Now, the reason we know the rest of the story is because there was an orderly who worked in the warden's office, and he was present doing his duties when the sheriff came in to talk to the warden, and they blustered with the door open, not paying any attention to this orderly who was cleaning up the office, the waiting room and all. He heard the sheriff tell the warden what had happened, and he said, it's a good thing them boys from Montana didn't know what they were doing, because if they had known what they were doing, we would have been here to pick up the prisoners, and you would have had a problem. So, I don't tell the story very good, but that's what happened. It's a true story, and it describes not only the reality of what we're talking about, but our authority is real, and the fact that if you don't believe it's real, it really doesn't matter how real it is. Furthermore, if you don't have the courage and the determination to take it to whatever level is necessary, it doesn't matter how real it is. If you're not willing to put your life on the line, if you're not willing to go armed and ready to defend your oath of office, it doesn't mean anything. It's all show and tell. So does that answer your question, Dennis, or do I need to go further?
Yes, you did a great job on that. I would like also to see the appointment papers on that, because we'll probably do the same here whenever the time comes. So an example of the appointment papers, of how that looks like, and of course we can come up with our own seal. Go ahead.
It's not likely to happen. I doubt that that those papers even exist at this point in time anywhere except in my memory. But there's nothing special to it. If you have the ability to think logically and intelligently, so, you can write up an order as easily as I can.
Okay, yeah. The order by the common law court of what was the title in the authority given to the guys
we set several different courts at this particular time. Leroy's studies had led him to, I believe it was the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. United States Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. I believe that was the court that we ultimately used at that time.
Well, why not the bailiff?
Different office. The bailiff is not a marshal.
Typically, the bailiff is the one that carries out the orders of the court, though, isn't it?
Well,
inside the court.
What court you're talking about? In the United States courts, it's a marshal, a U.S. marshal or a federal marshal.
Okay.
Bailiff, read the legal definition of a bailiff. It's one who takes possession of the property.
Oh, okay.
He's holding the property in bailment. No, that's because they look at us as chattel property of their corporation. That's why they're called bailiffs. Back in the old days, in the old West, there were marshals were appointed by the judges in the circuit judges out in the territories. They would have their courts, and the court generally was a room behind the saloon, or it could be a room anywhere. It could be a room at a boarding house, and the judge would appoint a marshal and give him orders to go and pick up so-and-so or go and do this or go and do that. The marshals were appointed for specific purposes and functions.
Can I change directions? Something that Red Beckman said about they went in court every time. Can he elaborate a little bit more on that if he's still on?
Were you talking to me?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you guys went in court every time on the tax issues.
Well, we never even get to court.
Oh, okay.
Because, you see, the administrative procedure that the IRS goes through, they send out a 90-day letter. And this 90-day letter tells the victim their target. They say, if you want to go to tax court, if you want to petition the tax court, why, you write to Washington, D.C., and ask for the paperwork. And so you get the paperwork. They'll send it out to you. You fill it out. You put your $65 with it. I think it's still $65. Send your petition in to go to tax court. You send that in, and after a period of time, you will get a deal back, and it'll say your petition to go to the tax court has been accepted, and your trial date is set for such and such, usually 5 or 6 months down the road. Well, we used to recommend that people don't go to the tax court because we knew that it was a kangaroo setup. It wasn't a court at all because there's no constitutional due process. It's strictly administrative procedures written by IRS people and such for their benefit. And they've gotten a lot of suckers over the years. Well, what we tell the people is you wait a month or two, a little time, get your head screwed on right a little bit, and you sit down and you write a motion to dismiss. And in this motion to dismiss, you just make it very, very short and sweet. You can put the motion to dismiss right on the cover sheet of this motion. Now, you're common law. Now, you're not statute and case law, or statute law. You're not using administrative procedures. You don't have to be doing this like a lawyer, and you put a motion in the court to dismiss the action, and you say based on number one, a judicial notice, and that judicial notice, you put the judge on notice of the fact that he is a beneficiary of the income tax law, and because his salary comes from from tax money, and then the next thing you do, to support it, you put in a short affidavit. You have that affidavit notarized, and the whole works. And basically, I tell people, your affidavit doesn't have to be more than one page. I'd say two pages at the maximum. And you just say, well, when I got the 90-day letter, I panicked. I lost sleep. I lost appetite. I was hard to live with around my family and all. And then I start hitting the books and checking things out. And I came to the conclusion, I of course, I'm biased, and I tell them, say that you got a copy of the law that never was, Volume 1, and that you've discovered that this is a massive fraud that has been perpetrated on the Constitution and on the people of this country, and that the IRS is nothing more than a domestic terrorist organization. And then the last thing you put in is an exhibit where you put the Judicial Code of Ethics, and you need a highlighter, and you highlight the section that deals with conflicts of interest. If a judge has a conflict of interest, he has to back off. He has to get out of the picture. Well, there's no jury in tax court. It's not a constitutional court at all, and the judge has no choice. He has to dismiss the action. And from what has happened, some of these have been back quite a ways, quite a number of years. I have not heard or seen where anybody that has ever done this has never had any more conflict with the Internal Revenue Service, because when you hit them with this simple thing, I've had some very significant things in my own case. I'm not going to tell you all I've done, because I've done some things that no one else has done, I guess, and I've had some fantastic results. But we've had traffic cases where people have cited the judge, the city traffic court judge in a city. The municipals all raised their fine, the amount of money for fines, speeding tickets, and no driver's license. They've doubled and tripled the cost so that they can continue have enough revenue to keep their pension plans alive and all of that. And so it's gotten pretty expensive. But when the individual cites city magistrate, the city judge, traffic judge, cite him for his conflict of interest, because he is a beneficiary of those taxes that he collects. And boy, I'll tell you, they they get out of it in a hurry. In one case, one of the first ones we had, the judge dismissed the traffic case on his own motion. And, of course, the guy collected some money from them for the misery and the problems. He filed a Title 42. And, of course, the city's liability insurance company, their attorneys, they don't mind paying off, making the city pay off, because they just raised the premiums. And so it's the tax court needs to be wiped out, and it can be done any time enough people get smart enough to do just like I've been telling here.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes left. I think Dr. Kate threw a question at me that I think, Stephen, we need to address. And her question is, so how does this relate, talking about the boards of review, how does this relate to Seventh Amendment juries or grand juries? And does the board of review replace this because of how messed up our system is? Stephen, my immediately response to her was that the boards of review are far superior to citizens' grand juries. A board of review has the ability to appoint a court if it chooses or has need. And the Seventh Amendment juries are a different animal altogether, but the commonality is that they are both under common law. Would you care to expound on that with the 3 minutes that we got left?
Well, yeah, you're right. The right to a common law court, a common law jury, is guaranteed by the Seventh Amendment. If the controversy, the value in controversy exceeds $20, the problem with that is that the courts do not know how to proceed according to the common law, the rules of the common law, and so it's that can be a sticky thing in and of itself. But it'll probably end right there if you ever get to that point, and they don't trick you into making some other mistake. But with regard to the boards of review being superior to a grand jury, the boards of review, once you understand the concept from Article 61 of Magna Carta, the board of review is whatever the people who create it want it to be. It doesn't have to follow the precepts outlined in Article 61 of Magna Carta at all. The people are creating the Board of Review for their purposes to hold their servants accountable to their oaths of office. So the Board of Review can be in function as a grand jury and probably should, but it also would need to function as a court, because there is no way that any grand jury can exist apart from a court. And that's probably the biggest argument that I have with the proponents of the common law grand juries. A grand jury cannot exist anywhere without a court. The court has to create or seat the grand jury. It's true that the courts don't have the ability to control the grand jury, but in the end, because you've got an attorney running the whole show and making the decision as to whether or not...
We got 30 seconds, Stephen.
Oh, sorry. Whether or not they can prosecute, it's up to the prosecuting attorney. So
exactly.
Boards of review are superior in every way.
Stephen, thank you very much. Gus Breton, thank you. Jim Cook, Doug Millar, Red Beckman, Dr. Kate, and this is Terry Dodd signing off for the night. Thanks for joining us for Walls in Our Minds, and we'll see you next week.